Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the review session. Not too much to add, other than the no quiz this week because of today's topic and then Tuesday getting disrupted. Today we're just gonna, I'm just gonna sort of answer questions best I can. And when we run out of questions, then, or the class time expires, whichever comes first, we'll call it good there. Any questions, logistically questions? Yeah.
Is this quiz gonna be like made up, or are the rest of the quizzes gonna be weighted more like at the end of the semester to like make up for the missing like 2% or whatever it is?
I guess all the quizzes will be worth a little bit more because we'll just have fewer. Yeah.
So for the HTML part one submission, that's just getting one of the functions to work at faster. You don't have to do the license stuff or like the make file or anything. It's just getting the license or getting the one of the two functions working.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's just the functions.
Okay.
You know, the submission section is pretty clear about which files it wants. But yeah.
Will the midterm be in the same format as the quizzes, like just kind of style of questions?
Will the midterm be the same format as the quizzes? Kind of. I guess it depends on whether you think the style of questions in the practice exams is like the quizzes. There's definitely, we're not sort of going to change as instructors and start asking completely different things. I think, though, that the quizzes are sort of designed that you have a lot more than 75 minutes to complete it. And so those questions can be a little bit more intricate. And I think the practice exam questions are a little bit more scoped. But I wouldn't look at the quiz questions and go, okay, the exam can be completely different than this. I don't know if that's, hopefully that's at least something of an answer. Anything else? Yeah.
Is it going to be on the same testing software? Will we take it?
Will the midterm be sort of through that same website as the quizzes? No. So it should be on paper, in class, right here. Any other logistical questions? All right. Okay, so you might have seen on Piazza, I sort of call for topics. And so we sort of pre-cached a few things to discuss. Are there other questions, topics that you want to add to this list? Yeah?
Kind of what triggers a context switch?
Okay. Sure.
Can we look at the last question on the
most recent quiz? Do you remember what the topic was? It caches?
Virtual pages.
Or pages?
Okay.
Specifically with second level. Yep. Turn mode and user mode. Also, the for the user.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, defining those and when to switch between them.
A root user, you said, right? anything else right now? Okay. All right, cool. Well, we will we'll go through this. Okay, so we'll start with kind of try to group by topics, but just kind of go through these. So, you know, we started the semester building programs, and we think about the linker. Let's see here. We call the linker with a lot of the same. Where's the same arguments we would call a compiler. Okay. So you know, in tools like Clang or GCC make this easy to use the same executable, and they sort of figure this out. The key to the linker is basically we have some arguments. So we have some flags for options. Different optimizations, different sort of warnings we want, things like that. We then have our object files, which are sort of our pre-compiled binaries that we want to include in our output. We might have archives or libraries. That we're including, then we generally have dash O for output, right? And this is our executable. And then we have a couple other flags that are sort of really only used or are only used as a linker. So dash lowercase l, and you might see like dash lowercase ln for link with the system math library. So this is telling the linker when we're actually putting all of this code together and we're looking for other functions that don't exist in these object files, we need to also include the system level library. And then we also had capital L, which is a way to specify paths. And so when we actually go run this program, if we have other external libraries, and they're not in sort of known system locations, like the math library, the M that we're working with here, that's going to be in a known location that an executable running on the system will know. If we have some sort of custom special library, and it's in a particular location, we can specify that here. So then when we go to run that executable, it knows where to look for that particular shared library. I think that's the highlights. Yeah?
I know the executable name usually follows the minus O, but is the order of the other arguments really
that? So this is like one option here. Do the other sort of arguments have an order? Yes and no. So some ordering does matter, but for simple cases, it's usually not an issue. I think for the sake of our discussion, we don't need to worry about that. Okay. All right. So there's a question about the fall 2023. Let's see.
questions? Okay. Let's see here. Way too much. Yeah. Okay, great. We got the whole question here. Okay. So this is looking at a make example make file here, and the question is. Basically, it's telling us, right, that this part looks odd, right? Why does that not look like what we expect? Yeah?
You want the object files in the requirements, not the C files?
That's right. So our inputs here, right, are not C, yet what we're actually using in our build commands are dot O's. And so we're sort of telling make that our input dependencies are not really what we're using. And, you know, for better or worse, make is just going to kind of trust us. So it doesn't have any way to sort of, it's not going to try to verify this on our behalf. And so the question is basically, what can go wrong? And then there's a few options, and it's asking us to select all the ones that could go wrong, right? Okay, so let's just go through this. So utility.h is modified, so we expect something to rebuild, yet we don't rebuild application. Okay, could that happen? So we do have utility.h, right, as, you know, an input dependency in a couple recipes here. But the question is, will make figure out that we need to rebuild application? Well, for that to be true, there needs to be some chain that goes back to utility.h. We don't actually specify utility.h here. And if we look at, so that what we are specifying, main.c, utility.c, those didn't change. There's no rules to build those, as you wouldn't expect, right? Because those we expect to just be files. And so there's nothing here telling make that if utility.h changes, we should rebuild application. So this would be a problem. Now, if utility.h changes, we don't rebuild main.o? Well, okay, so where do we build main.o? So that's going to be an output. And if any of the dependencies change, in this case, we are listing utility.h. And so there we will make, we'll figure out, okay, yeah, we do need to rebuild main.o. So that one will happen. And so the same, okay, so now we have utility.c, will we not rebuild utility.o? So we can look at, again, where we, you know, what we're asking about. Would we rebuild utility.o? Well, utility.c is listed as a dependency. As an input, so we should be fine there, right? And if we look at this, you know, also utility.c is here, so we'd actually rebuild application too, but that's not what we're asking about. Utility.o will get rebuilt. There's a file not found error for main.c. So here in application, right, we're depending on main.c. We can look, we don't have any rules that will build it. But a C file, right, that's what we write. So that's, we expect it to just be a normal file. And so either so that everything will break or that file was there, but we expect that file will be there. Now what about main.o? Was there a file not found error for main.o? Well, we do have a rule that will build main.o, but when we look at what make all is asking, it's going to ask for sort of application main.o and utility.o. So we're going to build everything. Okay, that's great. the problem is that we're telling main, I'm sorry, we're telling make that we can build all these things. If it looks at application, okay, this is the rules, I need main.c, utility.c. If both of those files exist, it's going to go ahead and execute this. Which it is purview to do. The problem is that we may not have built main.o yet. And so we can have a found not found error. And so that's why we have to get these dependency chains right so that the rules we expect actually match. Yeah?
So when you like do make all, will it go in order of like the things you list? So if you had like main.o before, would that like solve that problem?
Yeah, so if we had moved main.o here, that would likely solve that problem. It does say that we just invoke make all without any flags telling it to run in certain level of parallelism. So we would be maybe okay. But in general, if we don't specify the dependencies correctly, sort of make is allowed to conceptually change that around. We're not going to sort of ask about that level of like ordering because we don't want to write make files that way.
And just to clarify, similarly in the dependencies for application, if utility.h was included alongside main.c and utility.c, would that solve the problem of make not rebuilding application if utility.h is modified?
Yes, that would. We still could run into issues with not having the object files, but at least if we got it to run one time and this was, you know, the utility.h was here, then that would take care of that first problem. All right. Okay, spring. Question 9A. So kind of similar flavor question, right? We're building a library from these files. Every C file has a corresponding header file, pretty common. Both main and C use functions defined in utilities and declared in utilities and include the header file to do so. Main.c also uses functions that are defined in parsing.c and uses parsing.h. Okay, and so in a make file, we might have sort of this template, okay? And we want to specify what the dependencies are to make this work sort of reliably, correctly to do this. Okay, so of these sort of files, the files we just described, which ones do we need to make that happen? So dependencies kind of have two purposes, right? One is it's going to be used by the command. So we need to make sure that file exists because otherwise that command can't run correctly. We can look at what files are specified here. So we have main.o, but this is what we're actually creating, right? So it is correctly specified as our output. That's why it's specified to the left side of the column. The other file that's specified here is main.c. So that's an input. So we definitely want to include that in our list of dependencies. Okay? Now, what else do we want to check here? Well, what does the question say? So main.c uses functions from utilities.c and declared utilities.h. Okay. And so what do we need to or what do we want to make a dependency so that if something you know changes, we correctly get this command to rebuild the output file. So the way that we generate and write code in C, the header file expresses the sort of interface between different files, and that's actually what's included from main.c. Right? And that's what we said here. And so in order to actually compile this file, the parser is going to have to look and say, okay, you've got this includes file with this header file, so I need to go find that header file. And includes is literally just like pasting it there, right? And so to do that, that's going to be an input. And if we change utilities.h, then we're going to have to change what gets inserted into our C file. And so we definitely want to include that as well. Now, the same logic is going to go for parsing.h, because again, we're including that, and so when it gets compiled, it's basically getting copied in. If that changes, we need to copy in something else. Now, we have some other files we have to think about here. So, we have some compiled object files. So we already talked about main.o, that's the output, so that's definitely, you know, this is definitely not it. What about utilities.o and parsing.o? Well, the whole point is that we want to compile these separately, and so we only have to recompile what's changed. It doesn't make sense that we would include another object file to build this object file, right? And we've never seen that. And then the last bit here, okay, so we have a main.s. .s is assembly files, generally. That doesn't seem like we have any assembly files. Now, we could, there's ways to get the compiler to admit that, but that would be an output, so there's nothing to include here. And then finally, this .c files. Like, should we specify the .c files as dependencies since we're using functions defined in those? And the answer is no, right? We don't include sort of other .c files. Those are going to get compiled as separate objects, and then the linking stage is what's going to tie that together. And this is important because if we have a bunch of .c files, we really want to be able to compile them individually. The object files will just know, oh yeah, I've got this reference, this function, it's defined elsewhere, that's fine. When I do the linking step, that's where I'll stitch everything together. I'll wait till then, I don't want to spend the, there's nothing I can do now. And so we're not going to include these other C files, just the header files, because those are actually included in the compilation. Yeah?
So then when we compile the final executable, are we going to have the C files, all the C files as dependencies, or is it just each C file's object file that'll be the final?
Yeah, so we're going to end up with something like we're going to have our ultimate, one example of this, right? So we have our sort of output executable that can depend on a series of .o files, and then those, will depend on their corresponding .c file. And so in the make system, we're going to sort of build up this tree structure of dependencies. And so that's why if we say we're to change just the C file, make can trick us through and say, okay, well, I need to regenerate that .o file, and that's a dependency input for the exe, so I need to rebuild that. But I'm not going to spend time doing like this compilation step again.
So this like main C file only needs to know like how those functions that it calls from utilities and parsing, like actually the function signature doesn't actually need to know.
That's right. So main.c does just need to know the function signature, and that's what's expressed in the header file. And the compiler is like, okay, I'm going to keep track of that. I know that we're going to call this other function, but I don't need to know what that is right now. It's only when we actually want to generate that final executable that the linker needs to figure out, okay, do I actually have all these functions or not? Now, we don't even, I mean, the header file is just sort of giving the compiler a sense of what's going on. That's why sometimes we'll get a warning saying like, I couldn't find this, or this wasn't defined, but then things kind of still work. Because as long as that linking step can find it, it's fine. Okay, all right. Okay, so we talked about this. So permissions. Okay. So we've talked a lot, or we've used in this class, right, the get versions of these. Right, get like UID or get group. ID, things like that, right? Or we've done and we've done get PID. So the gets, I think, perhaps make a little bit more sense, right? We're just sort of asking the system, like, what are those sort of current IDs that I'm executing with? What about the sets? And sort of like, when would this be usable, right? Because generally speaking, we've said, you run a process, the process is going to be associated with a particular user ID that started that process, and then we use that user ID as a way to check permissions, as we want to access files or other system resources. And for most programs, this is a very common thing, right? However, there are certain programs, like being able to log into a system, like mounting a USB drive, that need sort of special permissions. And so we have this special bit in the executable permissions so that when it runs not as the user that started it, but as the user that sort of owns that executable. And this was a way that we could allow programs to run with this elevated privileges. Now we have to be, remember we said we have to be very, very careful about how we write those programs, because those extra permissions could be problematic. And you sort of imagine if you're running this program as these elevated permissions, as some other user, that could be very useful for being able to maybe access files that user has access to sort of on their behalf, or being able to do things like log into certain resources or mount hardware devices, things like that. But in reality, right, there's only a few, maybe you think about it as lines of code, that are actually the really sensitive lines of code. Right? Like, I need to be able to mount this file system. Okay, that's certainly something that requires special permissions. But all of the other lines of code instructions that we might need to execute are probably very benign. And so it's good practice that a program, an executable, will actually change its permissions over time. And so when it's doing something that needs the extra permissions, it will have them, but then it will actually change its user ID to something with lower permissions for the things that don't require those elevated permissions. And why do that? Well, that's sort of reducing the attack surface or the potential for things to go wrong. Right? There's less time, less instructions that are executing in a higher privilege mode where if something were to go wrong, that could be problematic for the system. So that's kind of the motivation behind these things. So generally speaking, our programs are not going to use these, but when we're writing those sort of special programs that need elevated permissions sometimes, but not all the times, they can actually change their kind of permissions to match what they're actually trying to do. Okay. So speaking of, and so when we talk about these things, well, there's kind of like these sort of three levels that we sort of implicitly are thinking about. Let's see here. Okay. So often we might sort of draw a line here and kind of use this as our system call boundary. And so we're going to have, these are user mode processes on top, and then we have sort of the kernel kind of below this line, right? And sort of our system diagram here. And so this is going to be the half where that's our operating system, and then we want to be able to run a whole range of different processes running on that system. And so this is always going to be our user mode half. And so the nice thing about processes is we have all these big abstractions to make sure they're isolated. They don't compromise the entire system. We can control what they have access to and what they don't have access to. We can run them sort of simultaneously, right? Even on a single core machine, we can have this abstraction, this time sharing abstraction, so it seems like they all run simultaneously. It lets us break things up so that if one is waiting on something that's taking a long time, we can go and do other work, right? So there's all these benefits to having this sort of separation. To enforce a lot of those access controls, we need to separate the kernel and separate the operating system. And that way we have something that's mediating what's allowed. And so if this user mode calls a system call, this process calls a system call, the kernel can decide, should I permit that or not? Like, should I do that action or not? Now, to enable this, because at the end of the day, the kernel and the processes, they're just instructions running on a CPU, right? They're both just a series of instructions. The instruction set doesn't change whether we're writing a user-level program or the kernel. Yet, we need some way to let processes not do things while letting the kernel do them. And so to enable that, we actually have we have sort of a change in the hardware mode as we run in these in user mode or in kernel mode. And so the actual processor is letting the kernel execute additional things that the user mode process won't be able to access or won't be able to run. Now, if it tries to, that's one thing that can generate exception. Because the processor is like, wait a minute, I'm in user mode. That's a privileged instruction. It's valid, but you can't execute that. So I'm going to trap or there's an exception to the kernel to handle that however it wants to. And so this sort of permission divide is what allows us to implement a lot of the features that we've seen so far. Now, the other sort of level of differentiation here is that these processes are not all the same, right? So this can have a user ID of, say, 100, and then we can have, you know, user ID of 0. And so we can have some processes sort of run in their kind of their own privileged state. And these are the sort of pseudo programs, the root programs, that run still as user processes, right? They're still on this half of this divide, okay? However, by convention, by the way we've designed operating systems, we say programs running with root access are going to be granted more privileges than other programs. So they're still going to call system calls. They're still going to have to ask the OS. The OS is still going to have to permit the action, whatever it is, right? reading a certain file, sending a network packet, what have you. It's just that the kernel is going to be essentially a lot more lenient with those root programs and give it sort of special access. And that's useful because then it allows us to still write user-land programs, which have the same benefits, right? They still have virtual memory, et cetera, except we can use it to administer the system. Any questions? Yeah.
So, we talked about exceptions, but like a correct definition of an exception being whenever you switch to the kernel mode.
Is a correct definition of an exception whenever you switch to the kernel mode? Pretty much. However, an exception could happen while the kernel mode is executing. So one source of exceptions is a system call. So that's going to happen from user mode, call the system call that creates an exception, which then is handled by the kernel. The kernel can be executing and something like a timer could expire, or the network interface card could say, I have data ready. And depending on how things are configured, that could result in the exception handler running within the kernel. So an exception is sort of any time the hardware has some event happen that it needs the operating system to be involved in. And so it transfers control to one of those exception handling routines that are defined in the kernel. Okay, so just a couple notes on this idea of allocated memory, and kind of both of these are sort of a similar idea. So remember, we talked about fork. We said we're going to take one process, we're going to fork, that process forks, what it's doing is creating an exact copy of itself, except it has a different process ID because it's a separate process. And then sort of both are processes that can execute on the system, right? If you had a process that had been running for a while and had done a lot of things and allocated a lot of data structures, whatever, and then called fork, now, conceptually, the operating system is responsible for making a giant copy, a deep copy, right, of all of the resources that that original process had into this new process. And who knows what that new process is going to do. And so that can be very, very slow, right? Because that would be a lot of extra work. One of the tricks that sort of makes this design, which on the surface seems very inefficient, actually work pretty well, is this idea of copy on write. So now, instead of doing a sort of full deep copy where all the pages of memory are duplicated, you just have to duplicate that the page table information and then set the bits to say these pages are not writable. Like they still map to the correct data, they're still readable, but I don't need to make a full copy of it. Now once that new process then tries to change that memory, well, now the system has to go through and actually make that full copy because it needs to change memory that only that new process has, not what the old process or the original process had access to. And so this idea of copy on write. We only make the copy we actually need to. If it's not changed, right, the original process doesn't change it, the new process doesn't change it, well then what the copy that we had from before is still usable, we can just use it. And so it's sort of an optimization. That same idea is what happens if we're doing lazy allocation with page faults. We've told the program that, hey, look, here's all this memory that you have, but But in reality, we haven't actually gone and taken the physical memory and actually like set it aside for that program. Why? Well, we might not know exactly how much memory that program needs, and just sort of allocating it a bunch of memory that it never ends up using is just a waste. So we say, like, you've got access to this memory. Now we actually try to do the page table lookup when the program tries to use that memory that it thinks it has allocated. Well, that's going to fail, right? Because there is no entry. And we never actually put the entry in the page table, and so that fails. And at that point, we're going to have an exception. So hardware is like, I can't get you this physical memory. It's never been set up. And operating system's like, yeah, I know. I'm going to do it now. So that's the lazy part. I'm just going to do it whenever I need to, not in advance. And then the system can, now that page will actually be allocated. And so this is we can retry that memory access, and now it will actually be successful. So both cases are just for optimizations to say, like, let's not do a bunch of work ahead of time. Let's not allocate a bunch of resources ahead of time. Let's just wait until they're actually needed.
So a fault is an exception?
Yeah, fault is an exception.
Speaking of that, could you detail what a trap is?
So yeah, so sometimes I'll use these different terms, right? So fault, exception, trap, largely sort of interchangeable words. Some documentations, some different systems sort of use different terms. I guess we haven't really used trap in this class, but it does sort of mean that it's shorthand for trap to the operating system. So an exception happens, the operating system handles it. Okay, so let's just talk about signals briefly here, and if there's sort of more specific questions, we can talk about that. So this is sort of akin to an exception, but handled by the operating system. Basically a way to take some sort of process that's running and have the OS sort of signal to it that something, happened, right? And we've looked at, like, SIG user one, we've looked at, interrupt, kill, to terminate the process. But processes can sort of determine, like, how do I want to handle these, right? So by default, we're not doing anything. There's sort of no handling. We can set up a handler, right? So we can define a function in the program and then tell the operating system, hey, if I get this signal, for the ones that it can handle, right, I want you to run this function. We can also mask, mask a signal, and this says, don't deliver the signal to me, right? So basically, I want to prevent that signal from being delivered while it's masked. Later, when I'm ready to handle it, I might sort of unmask that. And then we also had SIG wait, right? And so we can wait for a particular signal. And this is kind of desirable, because it sort of avoids this issue where that signal might get delivered and start running the handler at sort of any point while our program is executing. And so what that means is we have to be very careful about what goes inside of here. By doing something like this, we sort of control like exactly where in our program we're going to be when that signal happens, and it can be easier to handle that event.
You have to mask the signal before you use SIG wait?
Do you have to mask the signal before you use SIG wait? Well, so if you, if it's, I'm trying to remember. No, I mean, the short answer is no. You don't have to do sort of like anything, right? If the, you know, it's fine just to not mask anything. It just be, it's a way to sort of organize how things happen and when things can happen. All right. So make sure we get through everything here. Okay. Talk about that. Okay. Processes and file descriptors. Wait and dupe. Okay. All right. So we have file descriptors. Right. The key here is that this is actually an array. The file descriptors array stored by the kernel on behalf of our process is an array of pointers, right? And so this is going to point to actual file description that sort of exists somewhere else. And then our file descriptor is the index, right? So file descriptor of 1 is actually pointing somewhere in that array. And the reason this is really, really useful is it provides sort of a very efficient way to do a lot of operations that we want to do. And so when we fork and we have to copy everything, we need to make a copy of this data structure. And so this is on a fork that causes a copy. However, the pointers are the same. Same pointer, right? And so whatever open resources we had in the original, the parent process, those are still going to be open and accessible in the child process because they have the same file descriptors pointing to the same file description objects. So that's one really convenient feature of this particular abstraction. The other, another sort of, I believe it's old and then new, right? So we have the duplicate system call where we can sort of reassign our file descriptors to change kind of what they point to. And so if we had some file open with file descriptor 100, we want that to be standard out, right? We can call something like this. And so now our new file descriptor, so now this index here, if we're in the sort of parent process, instead of pointing to here, we'll just remove that pointer and have it point to this object over here. Right, and now somewhere down the line, we also had this one, points there as well. And so now if we call fork, right, this would not be here, it would be there. And so that's how we are allowed to do like redirection. Right, because now standard out is actually outputting to some other file descriptor, to some other location using that same file descriptor one. And when we close, we're closing the file descriptor, not the full description, unless it's the only thing left, right? But in this case, if we close this file descriptor, now we can't use that anymore. But the system knows that, oh, there's actually still something else, right? There's more than one reference to this, so this will go away. But it's not going to close the underlying resource because there's still another file descriptor that points to it.
How does the system know that there's still other file descriptors pointing to a file? Like, is there a table somewhere that stores that, or?
How
so the question is, how does the system like do that tracking? I don't know exactly how it's implemented in practice, but the system certainly has, at very least, knowledge of all of these file descriptor tables, right, and can check them. I'm guessing there's additional sort of either a reference count or something to help with that. Okay, and then also there was a question on weighting. And so typically, if we call weight, we've called fork before that, because that sort of means that we have sort of a second process something to wait on. Right? So we're generally going to have a structure that looks, again, something like this, and then we can go here and we can wait on that particular PID. And so the key here is that when fork returns, if we're in the parent process, then PID is set to the PID of the child process. And so this is a way to wait until that child process has finished. Now, we can only wait on sort of our own child processes, which is why it's typically coupled with fork. Any questions more about this, or sort of these topics, or things kind of related? Yeah?
What's the process ID of the parent process?
What's the process ID of the parent process? Good question. So we don't necessarily know, and you know, we don't often always need to know, but if we want to, right, we can ask. And you know, the parent's gonna have a parent, so we could ask for that too. And so you might have found this useful in the fork homework for debugging, because you can say, okay, I want to put this print statement in here, but I'm going to add get PID so I know which process called it, because I'm not sure, was it the parent or the child that was running this statement? And so that can be kind of helpful to keep track of, like, which process is actually executing something. All right. Oops, I have to keep going back to ours. Okay. So we talked about exceptions, trap, same thing, fault, same thing, same meaning as exception. Something has happened and the hardware is at a point where it detected that this thing happened, right? Because if it's a system call, that's an instruction, the hardware is responsible for executing instructions, but it has no idea what we should do in response to that system call, like what the operating system wants. And so it has to transfer control back to the operating system and say, and it runs a specific code, this happened, deal with it, right? And it could be things like divide by zero, a page fault, right, all of these things. But then there's kind of this other class of exceptions, which are coming from elsewhere in the system. Things like, or basically this class of interrupts. And so one sort of common example is a timer, because you might want to say, let a process start running, but then have a timer in the background. So if that process sort of never stops running, maybe it's stuck in a loop, maybe it's doing a lot of computation, but never calls a system call. So it never sort of voluntarily relinquishes control back to the operating system. By having that timer running, it can trigger an interrupt, and then the hardware will use that as an exception to get back to the operating system. So the operating system would be like, well, wait a minute, this one process is running too long, I want to switch and let something else run too. So that's one example. But there's a whole host. So your storage device,
might take some time to go find. If you ask for a particular region of that storage, it takes some time to do that. And so in the meantime, the cluster wants to be going off and doing something else, but eventually the storage finds what it was looking for and then generates an interrupt back to the processor to say, hey, I'm done. I've got this access to this file. Anyway, we had, and they're still in use today. Now we have a lot of solid state drives, which are much faster, but traditional spinning disk hard drives, right, actually have a platter, or there are many platters that are spinning, and a little needle that has to move. And so you've got physical things moving. That takes like real, actual time. And so there was a lot of latency there, and so it made sense that, like, I'm not going to sit there and wait for you to figure this out. I'm going to let the processor keep executing. You just send me an interrupt when you've actually gotten things and found the right data. Or other things, button presses, right? Interacting with us. Those are all I/O events that are going to generate interrupts so that the processor knows that we pushed a button, or that the face ID detection is finished, right? Whatever it is. Okay, so let's look at this example here. Spring. Do I have that open? I do. Okay. So this question is asking us, sort of imagine this particular sequence of events is happening on a machine like what we've talked about. Single core, and we've got sort of these three processes, okay? Now, during which of the steps is a system call likely to occur? So we look at these different sort of operations, and ask ourselves, is a system call going to happen here or not? Okay, so first, process A opens a file. How do we open files? Well, we call the open function from the library. What does the open function do? Calls the open system call. Because we need the operating system to check, like, does this file exist? Do we have permissions to access it? If so, actually allocate a file descriptor in that file descriptors array, which is maintained within the kernel's state for the process. And so we're going to need a system call to do that. Process A starts reading from the file. However, the data must first be transferred from disk. How do we read from a file? Well, we call the read function. What does the read function do? Calls the read system call, right? Because again, that sort of contents of those files is going to be stored wherever, and we're going to need the operating system to help. In this case, we actually know that we had to go to the disk, right? And so that's certainly not something our program can do without the operating system's help, so we definitely would have to call a system call. While process A is waiting, process B runs. System call? Well, no, right? Because so process A called the system call, it hasn't returned yet. Process B executes, but we don't know what process B is doing. For all we know, it's just adding a bunch of numbers together or whatever. And so no reason to think there was a system call there. Process B performs some computations, right? Doing a bunch of additions and multiplies, whatever. Right? Those are instructions that program can absolutely run. No reason to think that it would need to do a system call to do those. Process B is paused temporarily. Process C runs and performs some computations. So it's interesting. So now somehow process B stopped running, process C started. But the question is asking, did a system call occur? Well, we don't really have any reason to believe that process B was done with its computations. And so likely some other thing happened that caused the operating system to pause process B, perhaps that timer I was talking about fired, process C runs, it's also doing computations, no reason for it to call a system call, so nothing there. Process B resumes running, right, so for whatever reason, and sends a signal to process C. Aha. So now it's not doing computations, it's sending a signal. That signals are mediated by the operating system. And so to do that, right, there's no way that the process B can just do that without the operating system's help, without the kernel's help. And so this one, you know, we are going to need a system call. Process C's signal handler starts running. So certainly that's going to require the operating system to deliver that signal, but process C is not actually going to need to call a system call for that, just to, for that to start running. Process C signal handler prints out a message to the terminal. So now we are using an external resource. The process is writing to the terminal. Well, it's going to have to call write to do that, and that's a system call. And so expect to have one there. The contents of process A files are retrieved from disk, and as a result, process A resumes running. So that read that was sort of taking a long time is finally finished. Process A resumes. But maybe that was enough data, we don't know. But for just that to happen, we don't need another system call.
Is there any difference between like 3 and 5 in execution, or are they just like different ways of saying the same thing?
3 and 5. So while process A is waiting, process B runs. Process and 5, process B is paused, and process C runs. They're very similar. However, one difference between 3 and 5 is that in 3, process A called a system call. That system call didn't take a long time, and so the operating system used that to switch to process B. In 5, process B was paused temporarily. We're not really sure why, but the fact that it was doing computation sort of implies that something else happened. And so the net effect is the same between the two, but sort of the cause of the stopping is a little bit different. Yeah?
Why does switching between processes not cause a system call?
Why does switching between processes not cause a system call? Which, is there a specific number you're thinking of?
It's just I thought that it was like context switching.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe, like maybe 5 is actually a good example. Like why is 5 not a system call? And so remember, a system call is when a process explicitly invokes the system call instruction and wants sort of the kernel to do something on its behalf. But in 5, even though there was a context switch, right? You went from process B running to process C running. So we have a save state from process B, restore the state from process C so C could run. But neither one of them actually called a system call to do that. All right. Let's look at the time here. Okay, there's a question about sort of what triggers a context switch, which is definitely, of course, relevant to this. So a context switch is defined as anytime we're running one process and we start running a different process. And so we have to save the state from the process that was running, restore the state from the process that will start running. And that can happen for a couple different reasons. So we actually saw one example here. So in 3, process A asked for something that's going to take a while because it had to go all the way to disk. Again, that little arm has to seek. It takes forever. In the meantime, the process was like, well, I'm not just going to sit around and do nothing. I'm going to run something else. And so it's no longer running process A, context switch to process B. And so being able to make better use of the CPU is one reason. Another reason is something like what happened with 5. The process B maybe is doing some really long-running computation, and it's sort of using up the resource, the CPU to do that, but the operating system may not want that one process to be able to run for long periods of time without anything else being able to run. And if you think about that, this does happen to us sometimes, especially when, like, you have the spinning wheel or, you know, the spinning dial, right? Kind of everything's just kind of slow. Well, it's because something is running that's using up a lot of the CPU's time, and so the thing that's interacting with us is not running, and so we have to wait. And if we wait too long, everything just gets really hard to use. So the operating system wants to avoid that, and will actually do a context switch so that other things have a chance to run. So those are two key reasons why a context switch will occur. Yeah?
So just to, like, clarify, so, like, when there's a system call, there's usually going to be a context switch, and, like, not the other way around?
So a system call is separate from a context switch. So it's possible that, like we saw in, in 2 and 3 here, a system call, the operating system knows it's going to take a while, and so we context switch to another process. It's also possible that the operating system can answer that very quickly. So, like, get PID. That's a system call, but it's very easy for the operating system to respond. And so it's just going to return the value. It's not going to go through all the overhead of switching to another process in that way. And so while they're related, because a system call is maybe a reason or the instigation that could lead to a context switch, but it's not guaranteed. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you do B?
Can we do B real quick? Yes. So which of the steps is a non-system call exception likely to occur? So opening a file, no. Reading from a file, no. Right, process A is waiting, right? No. Process B performing computations, no. Right, these are all kind of just the program is running, it's calling system calls so far. We need some evidence that something else outside of the program executing caused an exception. And 5 is kind of where we see that, right? Like, something caused process B to be paused. It was just executing the instructions and doing some computation, so it wouldn't have stopped itself. And so for it to be paused temporarily, you know, maybe that was the timer expiring. So it's likely that it happened there. Process B resumes running and sends a signal to process C. Well, again, so now process C was running, and for some reason it stopped, but it was doing computation. So the same reasoning, why did we switch back to process C? Well, again, probably that timer fired. Sending a signal, right? So that's, there's no additional exception there. The context switch is going to send the signal, but that's it. The operating system doing the context switch back to process C, doesn't cause an additional exception. We do get the exception here, right, for printing out a message, but that's a system call. And then finally in 9, now we finally heard back from the disk, so we can run process A. That's going to be an interrupt from the hard drive or from that disk to the system and say, hey, the thing you asked for is ready. And so that's going to be another exception. All right. All right, we're a little short on time. I want to make sure we discuss caches at least a little bit. Where is that? Oops.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's five. Okay. So this question is a little bit long, but. I think it is helpful just to sort of use it as an example of looking at a cache. So in this case, we have a direct nav cache, right, with these parameters. And so if we have 256 byte blocks, that means we have 8 offset bits. And then if the total cache is 2 to the 14, that means we need 6 index bits. And then the remaining bits are going to be the tag, right? And so if it's direct map, that means every memory location has exactly one place where it could go in this cache. And so multiple memory addresses are going to alias to the same location, and they can evict each other. And so part A here is asking, if we run this function with these inputs, and if we look at this, we're taking table 1 and we're indexing with this computation here. So x is 0. But there's some secret value here. And then that's causing, and then that's one lookup. And then we're also looking at table 2, which is another memory access. And so between the two of those, we're evicting from indexes 4 and 10. So again, sorry about kind of going through this question quickly, but hopefully if you revisit this again on your own, the you can fill in the rest of the pieces here. But the key is that the question essentially boils down to, what do we have to do, essentially what is secret, such that we're going to get this sort of cache behavior? Well, we know that for a direct map cache, if index 4 is going to be used, then the index bits have to match that. And so if we look at a hex value here, we have 8 bits for the offset. So we have sort of lower 4 bits, groups of 4 bits. This is our 8 bits that just index into that sort of a block. And then we're going to have 6 bits above that determine our index, and everything else is the tag. And so if our index is 4, that means that here in binary, we have to have 4. And if our index was 10, then we're going to have that, right? So this is just OX4, and this is OXA. And so the memory addresses that we could use, and if we look at where these tables are stored, these are, you know, these bits are much higher, so those are just going to be in the tag, so that's not going to affect our cache. And so, for example, we could have OX4 and then sort of anything here. That memory address will evict this particular cache index. Now, this question is the one other thing we need to note here is that these are integers and not bytes. And so the address, any address would work. We could set these bits to anything. We need to have this be either 4 or 10. But then, because we're using an int here, we're going to actually, we have to basically divide this by 4. So this is definitely asking about sort of like, you know, additional things that we haven't talked about yet, but I think it's worth sort of being able to break down the bits in this cache and then think about, like, what does it take for different addresses to use the same index in the cache? All right, sorry, went over long. And again, if we have any other additional questions, please, you know, come to office hours and ask NPR.